Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
Ace Abbott is with us. He is the author of The Rogue Aviator and In the Back Alleys of Aviation. He's had a 36-year career as a professional pilot. Ace Abbott flew iconic celebrities such as Bob Marley, Jimmy Buffett, along with sports stars, Palm Beach Society, and drug dealers. He was a featured author in the 2011 Oshkosh Air Show and gave a speech titled Pilot Fatigue, Unions and the FAA. Again, his book, The Rogue Aviator in the Back Alleys of Aviation, details the turbulent adventures of his aviation career while visiting 44 countries with 25 employers. And let's say, Ace, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Michael Ray. I'm looking forward to talking to you and your audience this evening.
Wonderful, and thank you so much for being here. You know, you take a look at aviation, you've been at it for 36 years now, and I'm sure you've seen a tremendous amount of changes. Ace, in the aviation industry, what's that one overarching theme, that one certain something that was completely different today than it was 36 years ago?
Well, I guess the very significant difference is the fact that 36 years ago, pilots were more carefree, freewheeling, swashbuckling, free spirits, if you will. And now with today's automation, it's much more of a regimented, dot the I's, cross the T's work environment, basically, with the computer and the autopilot doing most of the work. In the old days, there was a lot more thinking required on the flight deck and a lot more hands-on actual stick and rudder flying. That's one of the big differences. I think another factor, too, is that back in the 60s and 70s in particular, the pilot was, commercial pilot in particular, was held in relatively high esteem. And unfortunately, the commercial professional pilot, I don't think, has quite the status that he did 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, Ace, when was it safer then? Was it safer then than it is now? You said something, I think, that's the operative words here. The pilot had more control. They thought about it. They could maneuver. They could do whatever they had to do. Now it's automated. Where was there more safety, in the old days or today?
Well, that can be a double-edged sword because, generally speaking, I will say today, particularly based on the reduced number of fatal serious accidents in recent years, as a result of the automation and... I do talk about pilot fatigue in my book, and I cite several examples of my duty days that were in excess of 20 hours, sometimes 24 hours of duty. In those situations, it was more of an unsafe flight environment. However, in today's environment, with the autopilot flying the airplane, it reduces the problem to a degree of fatigued pilots or pilots that aren't as proficient as they were in the back in 30, 40, 50 years ago. So but across the board, aviation has gotten safer in the last 10, 12, 15, 20 years as a result of a lot of the changes that have been implemented by the pilot unions in particular. ALPA, for instance, spearheaded a program at the United Airlines about 25 years ago called CRM, which is Cockpit Resource Management. And basically that was a program where it allowed the pilots to interact more openly on the flight deck rather than having the ultimate kahuna tyrant captain making all the calls. The other to fight often, flight crew members would be more involved in decision-making. And that was a major step forward in airline safety, very significant.
Yeah, but when you look at it, let's go back to, you and I probably came from just around the same era. And today's world, it's a completely different world, completely different culture, and we're bringing out a new person, whoever that is, in all the different industries. The pilot of 36 years ago and the pilot of today, if you think about this, the pilot of today has got all of the widgets and the gadgets and everything else to use and press a button and do this in the autopilot. But what happens, Ace? What happens when there is a real problem? What happens when the autopilot is not there? Do they have that skill set, that survival skill set, to bring the passengers out of it and quote unquote come down to safety? Is there the critical thinking?
And that is one of the major issues in aviation at that time. You hit a nail right on the head, Michael Ray, because effectively, the answer is no. They do not have the level of skills that the older pilots did because they simply haven't flown the airplane as much under various demanding circumstances with the autopilot inoperative. And in my book, The Rogue Aviator, I do cite that. As a matter of fact, I cite a takeoff departure from San Francisco that nearly ended up splattering on the hillside up there in San Bruno on the north side of San Francisco. And that was a situation where the pilot controls was not proficient in flying that aircraft because, first of all, he hadn't flown that much in recent times, as is the case with the long-haul pilots that fly 747s and 777s all over the world. They effectively only fly maybe four or five flights a month, and then they're splitting time with the co-pilot or other flight deck pilots. Their skills aren't nearly at the level they were. And the bright side is, though, that you can take a person with minimal flight experience and put them in that Airbus, for instance, that's very, very automated, fly-by-wire. It wants to do everything for you. And they can get the airplane from A to B quite successfully unless something out of the ordinary happens and the computer goes cattywampus and doesn't give the pilots the input. And, the aircraft accident that's been getting a lot of publicity in recent times is the Air France 447 that went down off the coast of northeast coast of Venezuela. And that was a situation where those pilots simply flew the airplane into a stall and maintained the stall. They never allowed the airplane or flew the airplane out of the stall. At least that's what they're pulling out of the cockpit voice recorders. So that's a prime example of your premise right there.
It almost reminds me of a situation that analogous to this. You walk into the market to buy groceries, and you got somebody that's 50 years old plus behind the counter, and you hand them a $20 bill, and they count you back change. They think. You do that with a kid who's 18 or 19 years old, and sometimes they have a problem counting it back. And I'm going to give you that back to modern technology, and I would have to venture to guess that the pilots, the same thing. One of the things that you do talk about when, you know, pilot fatigue, how do you stay awake all those hours? And I don't care who you are. It's got to be very hard to sit in a chair and or a pilot seat. Well, it's still a chair. Sit in a chair for all of those hours and maintain a complete level of consciousness that's always critical and accurate.
Yes, it is, because it's a boring environment in that you're just sitting there monitoring, if you will. And it's very interesting, but several years ago, NASA was given $11 million funding to do a study regarding the possibility and effectivity of having pilots on long hauls on 4, 5, 6 hour flights or flights that are on the backside of the sleep cycle in the ODART 30 regime, of having them take scheduled cat naps en route, power naps, if you will, a 30 to 40 minute power nap. And when they're taking that power nap, of course, the other pilot is at a higher level of awareness. And then when the captain wakes up, the co-pilot takes his power nap. NASA determined that this would be a really effective thing to do and should be implemented. And the FAA, unfortunately, did nothing with it. However, interestingly enough, Michael Ray, is many of the foreign carriers, the European foreign carriers, have adopted this policy, and they're doing just that. Because the obvious thing is, we want to be well rested when we get to destination and have to shoot that approach down to 200 feet at Chicago here with blowing snow and slick runways. That's when you want to be well rested. And that en route cat nap really plays a big role. And we all know that when you're really tired, a 20 or 30 minute nap is unbelievably reviving.
Absolutely, I do it all the time on the air. we're just
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I hear you.
No, I love this segment. This is great. We're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at by the book?
Yeah, my website is the name of the book, 3 W's and therogueaviator.com, therogueaviator.com. The book is also available ebook at all the various ebook places, Amazon, etc., ad infinitum, and it can be purchased through Atlas Book Distributors and or Baker and Taylor, etc., ad infinitum. But at any rate, go to the website and it'll tell you a lot more about the book, including some reader reviews and some excerpts.
Dynamite. Hey, Ace Abbott, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Come and sing a simple song of freedom.
Yeah.
Sing it like you've never sung before. Let it fill.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Robert Ridgway with us. He's the author of How to Treat Your Dogs and Cats with Over-the-Counter Drugs. He's a graduate of Kansas State University College of Veterinary Medicine. He's a diplomat of the American College of Laboratory Animal Medicine and the American College of Preventative Medicine. Early in his career, he was a member of the U.S. Army Veterinary Corps and graduated from Officers Candidate School. And for the past 5 years, he's been employed by Orange County Animal Service. And let's say, hi, Robert. Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Thank you. Over-the-counter over-the-counter drugs. Is that scary? I mean, are they safe, really, for the animals when you're dealing with normal everyday problems? It seems like everybody wants to medicate and over-medicate.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. The problem is some of the people think that over-the-counter drugs, if people take it, it's good for animals, and that's not correct. And unfortunately, some of the drugs they have used too much and either made their pets extremely sick or killed them with over-the-counter drugs. And I thought, well, you know, by writing this book, I can help people not to do that kind of thing by just giving them the proper dose. And how much to give, how many days to give it, and go from there. And I looked online and found that on one particular drug, 1,500 dogs were presented for over-dosing with the compound. So that was one of the major reasons I wrote the book.
Now, by the way, If you were to have, and I know you see so many different types of problems with the animals, but if you had common problems people come in with, what does it boil down to? Are there certain problems they come to see you with that no matter what happens, you know when you open the door on Monday, you're going to have at least 10 cases of whatever?
Well, there are many that are very, very common. You know, intestinal parasites. Skin problems, eye problems, but each one of those have a different variation of the type of condition that can be present. And you just kind of have to know either what you've had your experience has been or have the capability to diagnose it with laboratory equipment. And with the one of the things on the book that I pointed out is that diagnosis of a condition, a lot of people may be in the twilight zone, quite frankly. But obviously, if they don't have their dog is losing hair, they can see it, or their cat's losing hair. Sure. If their cat has a loose stool, you can see it. If the eye is running, you can say, oh, gosh, there's something wrong. Or if the eye is dry, which is a very common problem, and people just ignore it, and it can cause the animal to go blind. So, yes, there's many. In the book, I cover 103 different subjects.
I've got it in front of me right now. I've got the book right in front of me right now. I think it's great.
Oh, okay, right. Now, there's about 103 different subjects in the book that either tell you how to treat it or how to prevent it.
Okay, now, by the way, you're preaching to the choir here because I've got 3 dogs and 4 cats. So, and everything you
great.
Yeah, somebody's had one of the problems across the way. Let me get specific just for a moment, and I don't know what to do about
sure.
this problem, and it's a problem. I have 2 cats that I've had since they were five weeks old, and they got to be 10 years old, and they're still fine. Now, at 10 years old, they were introduced to 2 other cats. Through some problem, we ended up with 2 more cats, 2 female cats.
Uh-huh.
One of them spayed, one of them not spayed. Now, the little one hasn't been spayed yet, but the urine around this place is unbelievable. Everybody is marking everything they can possibly mark. And if I'm not on the radio doing a show, I've got the rug shampoo out and cleaning up the furniture.
Okay.
Is there anything to do to fix that?
Well, you know, there's many things that can cause that. One is, like you said, marking territory. However, I don't know if you've been able to observe the urine to see if it's yellow or if it's kind of brownish in color, whatever. One of the
it's
most
sticky.
Common things that happens with particularly cats, and it happens with dogs too, if they start urinating elsewhere, they have a urinary tract infection, and you need an antibiotic to treat it. And that's probably the number one thing that you want to think of is, geez, I got a urinary tract infection. The next thing is, if it is a territorial marking thing, which doesn't make sense to me, but it does occur, is that neutering the cat, either getting a spay or castrating the male cat, often will cause that marking to cease. That doesn't work 100%, but it's pretty effective.
Now, by the way, go ahead.
No, I was going to say the first thing I do is make sure that it's not a urinary tract infection.
Okay, but it's not just one cat. I've watched every one of the cats do it. The female cat, the boy cats, and somehow it's brown and sticky.
Well, if it's brown, it's a urinary tract infection. It should be yellow, just a normal urine color. And if it's brown, most likely it's a urinary tract infection. And so what happens is that they'll urinate more, and oftentimes you'll see them even drink more water than usual. Yeah. So it's a good idea. I mean, if you don't have the capability to get it diagnosed, take it to your pet's favorite doctor and have them take a look at it and let you know whether it is a urinary tract infection or not. It's best to know if it happens to be a urinary tract infection so you can take care of it. And all you got to do is give it some antibiotics, probably for less than 2 weeks, and it'll be over with.
Yeah, now, by the way, two things, an interesting point. But the first thing is, you got all four of them doing it. It's not like just one of them is doing it. They're all doing it.
Yeah.
But the other thing
I
is,
understand that.
How do you give a cat a pill?
sometimes it can be a challenge. But the way I do it is take your little finger and your ring finger and put it behind the head or around the neck. Take your thumb and index finger and put it at the commissure of the mouth. Take your opposite hand and pull the chin down with the tablet there, stick it into the mouth real quick, push it clear back to the throat, bing, and you can blow in her nose, and they'll swallow.
Huh.
It takes a little bit of practice, but that I have found to be the best way to do it. Oh, one other thing you do is kind of bring the cat up and have some old shirt on and let them kind of stick their claws into that shirt while you're doing this.
Oh, okay.
Right on your chest there. And that works pretty effectively. So you put your little finger and your ring finger behind the head, around the neck, your thumb and index finger at the commissures of the mouth, left and right, and then just open it, stick the pill in the mouth. Be real quick, because if you lollygag, they're going to fight you. You with me?
Oh, sure, no question about it.
All right.
Okay, all right. Yeah,
that's the best way to give a cat a pill.
One of those cats did have I did do a urinalysis on him. I got him into the vet, and we did the urinalysis. This one in particular, he's the biggest perpetrator, but he turned out okay. And they just don't want to stop. And it doesn't really matter because I'll never get rid of him. So one way or the other, we're going to find out what's going on here.
Yeah, well, is you said the male is a big guy. Has he been neutered?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the two males they're both big guys, and they've gotten two of the boys, they're neutered, and one of the cats, the females, are spayed. One of them isn't, and she goes into heat, I don't know, every couple of 3 weeks, and she's got this loud squealing sign. And I'll tell you what, Bob, this happened to me, and I don't know why it happened, but all of a sudden she goes into heat, I've become very popular around here.
Well, another thing that, you know, I don't know how often you clean the litter, but it's important. I like those little automatic things, because once they go to the bathroom, it cleans it out right away, and I have found it to be rather effective. It's not real good. Those are not very effective with groups of cats, and I don't. I know we had them where I work, and they had 12, 15 cats in there, and that's just too much for the workload of those little machines, and they can't handle it. But I don't know, about four cats probably handle it pretty well. And they all not going to go at the same time.
No. I'm a real stickler about that. I make sure that those things are clean once a day. you know, for the health of the house and also for the health of the cats.
Roger that. I hear you loud and clear.
Yeah. Now, by the way, let me ask you this. The book in and of itself, over-the-counter drugs, and I've got the book again. I've got it in my hand here, which for me is an absolute keeper. You do some of the symptoms of certain things, and then you follow it up with the treatment for it, which I think is absolutely brilliant.
Well, you know, I've had several people who have read the book from cover to cover, and they all seem to like it. And the other thing that I've tried real hard to do is to talk in lay terms. I'm not trying to snow anybody with this book. I want them to understand what it is that they're looking at. Let me give you an example. If I tell you to look at the medial canthus, have I communicated with you?
No.
No, I don't think so. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No.
But if I say, look at the corner of the eye that is next to your nose, you understand what I'm saying.
You got me.
And so that's the type of thing I tried to do in the book, and not to use any terms that's going to blow somebody away, and like I'm trying to impress you somehow or another. That's not my point. My point is I want to help people with this problem. And I found that a lot of people will never, ever take their pet to see a doctor of veterinary medicine. It just isn't going to happen. I know others who would, but they tell me they just cannot afford to do so. And then with the not knowing how to dose, those are the three major reasons why this book was printed in the first place, is to help people who need help and don't know what to do. They go and look, oh, my gosh, I don't know what to get, and so they get something and kill their pet.
Now, by the way, two things. We've got about 3 minutes to go, so we're starting to run out of time. But the first one is feeding the omega-3 fatty acids. I've been giving the dogs olive oil, virgin olive oil. Will that do the job?
Well, I don't know. I can't right offhand tell you if olive oil has omega fats in it. You know, the omega 3 fatty acids in it. I'm not that familiar with olive oil. So I guess I'm not the person to answer that particular question for you.
But the
omega-3s do make a difference in about 30-40% of the animals that receive it. Now, I know Mark M. Morris Jr., who's passed away now, who was his father's the one that started the Science Diet, and he was at Science Diet when he wrote the article. He found that a lot of rations sometimes, this is, of course, 30 years ago or more, so the rations are much better now than what they were back in those days. But he found that if a person was to add a hard-boiled egg and some, and he said, a tablespoon of Mazola corn oil, that it would help the coat just shine like a son of a gun. Now, what I found is that what he didn't tell us was that sometimes that corn oil will cause a loose stool. And in that case, you have to cut back on the amount of corn oil that you're giving to your pet. But that's supposed to help the hair coat of your pet. And I've had people tell me, well, gosh, I can't afford an egg every time I feed my dog. Well, you give the egg a hard-boiled egg as frequently as you can. Now, there's a reason for the hard-boiled egg, and that is that the white of the egg has a product called avidin. And avidin is supposed to tie up B vitamins, and you could cause a B vitamin deficiency in your pet by giving raw eggs. I can't tell you how many raw eggs it takes, and there's some controversy as to whether it really does occur, but it was certainly a question on my exam in vet school, I can tell you that.
Okay, so it's the hard-boiled egg.
Yes, sir.
Okay, the hard-boiled egg and also the Mazola corn oil, which is good. Bob, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and get more information?
Absolutely, www.authorridgeway.com. Now, my name, Ridgeway, is spelled without an E, contrary to popular demand. There is no E in Ridgeway. It's just R-I-D-G-W-A-Y. So, www.authorridgeway.com.
Now listen, I will never forget the name Ridgway, and there's a reason for that. When I was 11 years old, I was in the 7th grade, and Glenn Ridgway, who I was brought up with as a friend of mine, but when we first met, caught me in the men's room of the local show, and I'll tell you what, I found out what it was like to get the whatever beat out of you, so I'll never forget the name Ridgway.
Oh, wow. Well,
okay.
Okay,
Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. You have a great one.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you look on for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, yeah, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover. Nina Amir back with us, the author of How to Blog a Book, Write, Publish, and Promote Your Work One Post at a Time. Hey, Nina, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. Michael Ray, as always.
Have you had fun? Have you been having fun?
I have. I just got back from New York City, where I went to visit my kiddies.
Ah.
Children.
Yes. Nice. Did you get out and demonstrate? They arrested 178.
No, I avoided the demonstrations.
they arrested 178 people there. Did you have fun demonstrating? Right. Okay, let's get to this theme because it's important. So, and this especially, we're going to talk about how to map out the content of your book. And I got to tell you, I finally, I found myself as I'm writing, I'm looking at it and I'm saying, well, you know, if I go over it, that has nothing to do with what I just said. And I had to find out, I had to finally sit down and say, okay, I've got to strategize this thing. And then each time that I would go over something, I would make sure that the next paragraph or four or five down had to do with what I started out with. And it can't be just me. That's got to be a problem that most people get into. You get right in the middle of something, you're really going good, and you get off track somewhere.
That's right. And that's a really common problem. Really common problem. A lot of the people I work with, you know, their books come in and they think they're on track, and then partway through a chapter, they're not on track, or partway through the book, they're not on track. And it takes doing some pre-planning. And even then, they may still find that they're off track.
Okay, but you do something called developmental editing, and I think it's really important for the nonfiction books. What are we talking about?
So developmental editing means that I'm looking at a manuscript. I read the whole manuscript, and I go through, and I check to see if everything's in the right place. and if it all makes sense, or if something's missing, or if it's redundant. And so I'll go through and I make comments, and then I get back with the author, and we discuss that. But in general, they get the manuscript back with all these comments all over it, saying, you know, this is on the wrong place, it needs to get moved here, needs to get moved there, this needs to get deleted or cut or shortened, this needs to be expanded upon, this is unnecessary, again, this is redundant, you know, all of that. So that's developmental editing.
Oh, okay. Now, there's also something called line editing. Is that dropping it down to its essence?
That's looking at every single sentence you write and improving it, making it stronger, making it more active, making sure the grammar's correct, that sort of thing. There are other kinds of editing, too, but those are the two really important ones, the developmental editing and the line editing, because those are the developmental editing is going to ensure that your book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, of course, nonfiction is my specialty, but make sure that the story, whether it's, you know, a how-to book or a novel, that makes sure that everything's there and in place and makes sense. And then the line editing makes sure that your writing is the best writing it can be.
Okay, now, by the way,
that makes
the
sense.
Best, right? Yeah, absolutely, it makes sense. But when you say the best writing that it can be, when people start writing, are there schools somebody can go to say, this is how to be a writer? I'm sure there's somewhere, sometime. But most people, they're out there and they're living life and they're experiencing things and they begin to realize something, that aha moment goes on and they say, ah, I'm going to write about this, or something happened to them in their life. And I think that's really the key. They sit down and they start, but they have no concept of what you're saying.
Well, that's true, because most people don't start out as writers. I mean, there's some of us who do go out into the world with the intention of being a writer, and we get an education in writing or journalism or, you know, something that has to do with writing. And so we approach our writing differently. But a good portion of people go out into the world and just get inspired to write something or want to write something because it serves their business. You know, I worked with a writer who worked with a process called Emotional Freedom Technique, and this was his business, and he decided to write a book. But he wasn't a writer. This was just what he decided to write about. And so we had to work together to make his book coherent, because writing wasn't his first profession. And that's really common. The same, you know, with somebody I worked with, she was more of an artist, but she had a really, she had a way of, all through her life, she could see time, and she wanted to teach people about that, and she drew all these beautiful illustrations, and she wrote around it, and then, you know, this was, we had to really work to flesh out the information that went with her illustrations and with her book, and to make it into something that would help people. So these are the kinds of things that happen when you're not a writer, but you're inspired to write about something, or you're passionate about a topic and you want to write about it.
You know, we should write a book, and the book should be called The Cost of Prozac. I would imagine that most writers, there comes that point when they say, this is crazy, I'm going insane, this is nuts, I thought I knew what I was doing, but I don't know what I was doing, and they learn so much that they get overloaded.
Well, sure. You have too much information, and makes it very difficult as well, which is sometimes why planning in advance is better, because then you don't go off on all kinds of tangents and get way more information that you need. It's almost better to have a plan before and to know what you're going to write about so that you can fill in the gaps. You can say, okay, this is the information I need, and only research that. But with the internet and all of that, it's so easy to just spend all day researching and to end up with volumes and volumes of information that you never use.
Sure.
You can be there all day and never write. It's a great procrastination method.
Yeah, and I think one of the rules of the game, and I think it's a very strong rule, and you've heard me say this 1,000 times, and I'll say it 10 million more times, that talking is not communication. And I think that's one of the biggest problems, that when people sit down and put something to pen, because they say it doesn't mean that the audience is going to hear it in the way that they meant it. And I think that's a major problem for people who are going to sit down and start to write. And then, you know, there's the structuring of the sentences and so on and so forth. There's so much more that goes beyond it. So it's not just I've got an idea, I'm gonna start writing. It doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't. And so what happens is they get these ideas and they sit down and they just begin writing, or they start researching and then they start writing. And so what I really recommend to people is that they use a process that's been used a lot, and it's called mind mapping. And it can be done in a lot of different ways. But what it asks you to do is to rather than just outline, what's always, most people think, okay, I need to outline my book. And especially if you're a creative person, an outline is really kind of cut and dry. But for a creative person, they may have a lot of ideas floating around in their head, or they may have done, maybe they've done a lot of research and they have all this stuff floating around in their head and they have lots of papers and lots of things filed on their computers. So what you do, you can actually get programs on the computer that you can use, but what I suggest is they get a big poster board or even a whiteboard. Somebody just told me about this. Yeah. Get a big whiteboard and markers, you know, that you use on a whiteboard. Or just get a big poster board, and you can use markers or you can use sticky notes. I like the sticky note method. And you, in the middle of your whiteboard, or your poster board, you put a sticky note. Or again, you can use markers and just write the topic of your book. So let's say it's, you know, how to train a cat. You put that topic in the middle, and then you start doing what I call a big brain dump of everything you know. And you write that all around it. You know, just every topic you can think of, you know, how to feed a cat, how to train, you know, how to, if we're doing cat training, you know, it would be training with a leash, training with treats, training with punishment. You know, everything you can think of goes on the board. And if you're using sticky notes, you can start organizing immediately by moving things around. If you're using markers, you can use colored markers to categorize, and you can draw lines out and around, and you can use a highlighter later to highlight the different things that go together. But eventually you do start trying to organize it so that different thoughts you had that go together are easy to find. And you then use this big, huge brain dump that you did to organize your ideas into chapters. And then from that into subheadings. And once you've done that, you actually have a so-called outline, except that I don't really call it that. I call it chapters and subheads. And you can even go beyond that into, if you've done a lot of brainstorming, you would have chapters, subheads, and even subtopics under those subheads. So then you really have a writing guide that you can work with. And to me, that's the best way.
But can anybody in your house
do this mind mapping and map out the content in your book and where things are going to go?
Now, once you've done that, can anybody in your house get along with you?
They should be able to, because you should be able to think better.
Good. Now, when so many people decide they want to write a book, which I think is a great thing, it's wonderful. Katie Couric was doing an interview with Sting, and basically he said that he did an autobiography, and he dug down and he got a hold of those things that he was hiding, that he just didn't want to get out and he didn't want to face. But in the autobiography, he moved through it, found some forgiveness within him, and turned his life around and gave him some freedom he didn't have. So writing in and of itself can do that also. I think it's the best thing that people can do if they don't want to go to therapy.
Yeah, that's a whole other topic. I mean, I have a friend who, she's the Linda Joy Myers. She's the president of the National Association of Memoir Writers, and she wrote a book about the healing aspect of writing a memoir. And for a lot of people, that is the case, that they write a book, and it's or at least a memoir, and it has a healing quality to it.
No, but think about this. Let's say, for instance, that my mother beat me up when I was 6 years old, and I've never gotten over it. But if I sit down and write a book, and I create a character, and that character has a mother who did whatever that was that they had to do, and yada yada yada, that is a way for people, third party, to fictionalize something, and yet there is a lot of fact within that fiction that they clear themselves because they put it on a piece of paper, they see it, they get it up and out of them, even though it's in that quote-unquote third-party venue. So I think it works really well for people.
Well, that is true. And actually, I have not published it, but there's a novel that I wrote that I actually deal with a situation that I had with my son where I gave him the wrong medicine, and I had to take him to the emergency room.
Yeah.
And I fictionalized that.
Yeah.
And that is a very healing thing to do because you get to sort of put down on paper, you know, everything you went through, at least to some degree. And it is healing. But memoir even more so because you get to really delve into what went on in your life in a very honest way.
And besides
that, these days memoirs have a little... you make a statement at the beginning saying that some of this might not be true, but
and it's not me,
for the
it's
most part, it's memoir is supposed to be nonfiction. It's supposed to be the truth.
Yeah, and by the
as,
way,
as best
I
you know it.
I think that that's the most healing thing that someone can do because as you're writing, things come up that you hadn't thought about before, and by the time you're done, you've got your whole life sitting in front of you, and on paper, you could do one or two things with it. You've cleared it, throw it away, or put it together, put it in book form, get it published out there, and let somebody else get some healing out of it.
Right. But you want to know what? There's something about also writing a book, like this book that I am just finishing up, the How to Blog a Book. When you have some information that you can share, and you put it out there for all the world and say, I am the expert in this. I know something, and I want to share it with the world and give this so that I can help other people do something. It changes your perspective on yourself, and that is also very healing because a lot of people feel that they're not good enough. You know, they have self-esteem issues. They don't feel they're good enough. They don't feel they're worthy enough. They don't think they know anything. They don't think that they're an expert. And when you can say, I have something to share, something to give the world, and I can help other people in some way, that is really a big step forward. And so I would encourage people to look at that, too, because it's very healing able to say, look what I did. I actually have provided expert information to the world. And that's a whole different type of healing.
Oh, sure. What happens if through your material that you could reach out and touch someone 200 years from the day that you wrote it? Think about that. You know, you've written something so profound that would help somebody who would help somebody. And let's say it's on relationships, and somebody was frightened to death of getting in a relationship and getting married. So they read something in the book. In that book, they found a benefit, and from that benefit, they realized that it was okay to do so. So they end up getting married, and then they have kids, and those grandkids may become the king of the world in time. So you could reach out and touch people years from now, and it's a legacy in and of itself.
That's right. And I would recommend to people that, you know, if they don't feel that they have it within themselves to write a book, that they should start blogging. I have had some of the best experiences, most fulfilling experiences from readers of my blogs who've contacted me and said, I read this blog post and you changed my life.
Yeah.
Or you made my day. Or you gave me a totally different perspective on something. You know, just by writing 250 or 500 words and posting them on the internet.
No
question.
It's
an amazing thing.
And then you get
and
those
so,
guys.
You know, you can affect a lot of change by just writing something short and posting it on the internet. It's
yeah, somebody will see it. There's that shot of that moment of recognition then it's something that they can use, and or maybe it's something that they've been missing in their life that they can now use to turn their life around. Just a little millisecond, that split second of that aha moment, that just recognition of something that you can use to fix the problem makes all the difference in the world.
That's right.
Okay, now we're starting to...
That's why I encourage people to blog. Because also, the thing is that people, today, the average book sells 300 a year. And you can actually have 300 readers in a month very easily. Yeah, that's not very many. But you can start blogging, and before long, if you blog consistently, you can have 300 readers in a month. You know, and that's over, the average book sells 3,000 its lifetime. So you're going to have way more readers than that to your blog over the course of a year. So maybe not over the course of a year, but...
Yeah. All right, we're starting to run out of time. It always goes by too fast. Website we can find you at. How do we get a hold of you if we want to? If we need a copywriter, if we need somebody who's going to hold me by the hand and take me through it, how do we find you?
You can find me at ninaamir.com, which is www.ninaamir.com. And then if they're interested in writing and publishing, they can just click on the link that says Copyright Communications. And that's the easiest way to find me.
Wonderful. Glad you're back. We will see you next week.
Sounds great. Have a great week, Michael Ray.
You too. Good night.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Gina Radon here, and she is the author of Practical Genius, The Real Smarts You Need to Get Your Talents and Passions Working for You. She's the founder and the president of Genuine Insights, a contemporary professional development and training practice. And before launching her own firm, Gina worked on Fortune 500 companies, including Avon Products, PR Newswire. She's also the founder of Ted Mia, and lives in Miami with her husband and son. And let us say, Gina, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael Ray.
Oh, thank you for being here. I fell all over that one. Is it TEDx Mia? What
it's
is that?
TEDx MIA. MIA is actually the airport code for Miami, but in Spanish, MIA is Mia, so you did well.
Okay, we got it halfway there. All right, let me ask you this. Practical genius, the real smarts you need to get your talents and passions working for you. Most people don't think they can do that, and they don't think they can do that because they're not aware of it's inside of them in the first place. What's that first step to get somebody to really take a look at themselves and realize that there's more inside there than quote-unquote meets the eye?
Absolutely. The whole premise of Practical Genius is that it's a choice and it's not a gift. So for everyone listening, the first step to kind of embracing this notion that, wow, maybe I do possess genius, I'm here to tell you that you do. And the first step is a painless one, although I call it your genius autopsy. And it's looking at six ingredients that we all have within us. And to simplify it, I divide these six ingredients into two groups. And again, every single one of us possesses both the soft assets of who we are. This is who we are on the weekends. And then the hard professional assets of who we are. This is who we are 9 to 5. So to simplify this, the best way to look at it is the first contributing ingredients to your genius are your values. This is your belief system. This is what gets you up in the morning, your creative abilities, and your passions. And those three sets of ingredients are on the soft side. And most of us have been conditioned to ignore the soft side of who we are. So I always like to begin the Practical Genius process by getting folks to think about, wow, well, I really haven't thought about my values, my creative abilities, or my passions very much, or maybe I haven't taken them seriously. So the first step is really to look at those assets and to begin to really take them seriously. And then the second set of ingredients you've probably know from, you know, top of mind, and those are skills, your strengths, and your expertise. And those assets you're measured against within your organization, on teams. This side of who you are has been cultivated, and you probably have focused on this area most of your adult life. But the six ingredients together is really what the recipe for Practical Genius is.
Okay, let me ask you this. There are so many businesses that you've worked with. You know, you've been a lecturer, a trainer, a strategist, and you've worked with Fannie Mae, Booz Allen Hamilton, BET, the Interpublic Group, United States Department of Agriculture, the National Hispanic Leadership Institute, the Stern School of Business. I mean, this list goes on. These are professional organizations. These are, quote unquote, they're supposed to be sophisticated organizations. Gina, you personally, you walk in, what are they missing? What is that common denominator that you see missing in all of these major companies? Otherwise, if they weren't missing it, you wouldn't be there to talk.
Sure, sure. I think the overwhelming need that I've identified has really been, and I've been immersed in training and corporate coaching for the last 4 years and wrote the book after doing pretty much extensive research within these organizations. And the number one need that I've identified, which we all know is there is a lack of confidence with employees bringing their whole selves to work. So many of the folks that I've had the honor of working with have battled most of their life with what I call a Dr. Jekyll and a Mr. Hyde approach, and they're just tired of checking half of themselves at the door. So I think from an individual perspective, frustration, this becomes a retention issue, this becomes a quality of life challenge. People are tired of being living this kind of what I call Tupperware approach towards life, and they really would like to begin to be accepted and celebrated for all of their assets versus just the strategic logic ones. So on an individual basis, I think many of us have not brought our whole selves to work, and that's really unfortunate. And I think some of the organizations are producing average results because people are only bringing about 50% of themselves to the workplace, and they're only being measured against about 50% of their capabilities, which is another just huge missed opportunity. From an organizational perspective, during, you know, what I call economic turbulent times, budgets have been reduced, teams have been cut in half, everyone's desperate for innovation, and everyone's desperate to see who's going to rise to the occasion and be able to deliver results with half the staff and half the budget. And again, if you have and you're fostering a culture where people can come in and bring in all their assets, all their attributes, all of their genius to the table, then you're more likely to harness innovation in a creative way within a team, within an organization, for a professional, if you encourage and create a culture where they're, again, allowed to bring all of their assets to the forefront.
And they have to be able to do it without this thing called fear. Let me give you a prime example of that, and which stops probably 90% of what you're talking about implementing in these different businesses and organizations. An extreme example – your kid comes in and he or she says something to you, and you say, tell me the truth. And they tell you the truth, and you go, whack, okay. Now, the kid has learned what? If they tell the truth, they're going to get punished. Bring that up to politics today. If you ask a politician something, they're not going to give you their truth. They're going to give you what they think you want to hear, because if you tell them the truth, they're going to get whacked. All right. So the problem here is this. It's within the organization to be able to bring that trust where you can bring your vulnerability to the forefront and allow yourself to give everything there is without somebody waiting to, quote unquote, whack you when it happens. And I think that in and of itself is a major problem that we face, and no matter what size the business is, and even to the point of the kids and parents at home.
You are absolutely right, and it's the responsibility of the organization to realize if you don't embrace this kind of culture, what I think it's also a trend. Organizations aren't going to have a choice, but I also think it's up to the individual to, I always say, fear is false evidence appearing real. Everyone needs to check that fear and take the risk, because I'm also asking people to accept their contradictions. So when they set out to identify their genius, they have to accept what may appear to be opposing forces. Like, I've coached a financial leader within a finance team who was a vice president who really had a strong spiritual side, and he hid that spiritual side for many years within his organization until he just, you know, through working with him, I asked him to talk about it, to talk about his belief system, to bring his values to the forefront, to maybe even start, you know, which he ended up doing financial advisement for the congregation that he was serving on the weekend, so that he didn't feel this kind of, again, compromising of spiritual values, because his day job and his expertise, 50% of it was, you know, accounting and a pretty sharp CPA at that. So for the individuals listening, I really encourage you to explore and to begin to accept what may appear as contradictions. When you begin to out all of those sides of yourself, a lot of surprising opportunities begin to show themselves. And organizational leaders that are listening, you know, you have to get over the fear and allow people to take that risk and be open to a non-traditional conversation, which definitely happens when people decide to tell their manager, hey, you know what, on the weekends I play in a rock group, or on the weekends I'm doing financial planning within my church, or on the weekends I'm making jewelry and I want to be able to talk about my passion for making jewelry in the workplace. And people may think this doesn't matter or this isn't important, but it makes a huge difference on how managers, directors, professionals, all employees look at their work when they're scratching at that creativity in their spare time. It makes a huge difference. And in all the interviews that I conducted, and basically from thought leaders to educators to change agents to executives, those that were engaged in what Daniel Pink, another great author who I admire, calls using your whole mind, both the right side, which is the logic-driven side, and the left side. Actually, I'm sorry, the left side is the logic-driven side, and the right side of our brain is the creative side. When you use both sides together, the outcome is phenomenal.
No question.
That's the first phase to practical genius, is getting people to kind of figure out what the six ingredients are and then to really act upon them.
Now, you mentioned the S word, spirituality. And if you really wanted to define spirituality, I really believe if you got right down to the core of the essence of it, it just means honesty. It means integrity. Integrity is nothing more than expressing outwardly what you feel inwardly. And we do nothing but react. You know, our brain is an electrochemical factory. We protect ourselves. And what I found through all of the years, and I watch people very closely, and the very things that you create to protect yourself, which works. I mean, you survive, you live. But then there comes that point where those very things that cause you to protect yourself, you end up using against yourself, because you don't look at the opportunities that are in front of you that you could take advantage of. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, to move into any kind of program like this, Gina, you have to step outside of yourself. There's that old adage of thinking outside the box. We all think pretty much the same thing. We mix it up and it comes out a little different, but it's all the same thing. Thinking outside the box is, the definition is, thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. And it's stepping outside of yourself. And when you do that, and everybody does that within that area of expertise that you're dealing with at the time, you've got this brand new collaboration that would have never have happened.
You're absolutely right. And in Practical Genius, I write about listening to the heart. Because, again, to support what you're saying, you're absolutely just hit it on the mark. So many of us make decisions from the head. And when you talk about the word genius, everyone instantly thinks about IQ or genetics or this being a mental journey. I'm arguing that genius is, you know, located, if it had a physical address, it'd be located between the mind and the heart. But we should begin to shift the paradigm and live our life from an intuitive place that is led by listening to the heart. I interviewed Dr. Christian Northrup for the book, and she said, "Gina, we're not a brain on the stick. We're not a brain on a stick." And what she said is, so many of us don't listen to the heart, and also don't listen to our bodies. And one of the recommendations for sustaining genius in your life, if you just go about it from just a head-only place, you're really missing a huge opportunity. Following your passions, listening to your heart, and that intuitive messenger that we all have is a huge competitive advantage. And when you meet people that do lead from spirit, do lead from listening to their heart, their success is very multidimensional, and it's sustainable, and their quality of life is also sustainable. So
by the way,
it's interesting. This book sits on two shelves. It's a business motivation book. It's also a self-help book. And we got into this huge kind of debate with my publisher on what category I should be placed in. And because I'm passionate about both the mind and the heart, I would not give up my commitment to having this be within both a mindful section but also a heart-filled section for the very same reason.
You know, you mentioned the L word, logic, and logic is totally meaningless when you come down to it. Let's create a scenario here, okay? You want to buy a new sweater. So, yeah, you go into your local store, you go down the aisle, and you get into the section where the sweaters are. So you look up, and you see 40 sweaters up on that rack, and they're every color and style you can imagine. But your eyes go to that one. For whatever reason is, you recognize something in that sweater, that's the one that's going to do it for you. So you take it off the rack, you put it in your hands, and you're looking down at it, and you think, well, gee, if I buy the sweater, I can't pay the electric bill. Now, you would think your logic would stop you from buying the sweater. You see, that's not so, because if you look underneath the logic, your reasoning, what you'll find is the emotional satisfaction that you can get from paying the electric bill can be more emotionally satisfying than the sweater. Meaning that it's not the electric bill, it's what the electric bill represents. Your lights, your security, your air conditioning, whatever it is. So your decision is based on which is going to be the most emotionally satisfying for you. But before you make the decision, you got to see it. And I think that's where the problem is. We don't make any logical decisions, because in the end result is which is going to make us feel better. And that, no matter what, is a hard, fast rule.
That's so true. The second step in the Practical Genius model is around expressing your genius, and you just gave a great example, and you are a wonderful storyteller. And in this chapter, I'm really encouraging people to express their genius by bringing back the tradition and marrying authentic narrative to the art of storytelling. And for me, as a writer, when I set out to write Practical Genius, and I'm what they call a debut author, this is my first book, it was interesting to go through the writing process and to hear the stories of others and to capture them, and then to figure out, well, which storytellers are doing a really great job and which stories need improvement based on delivery or narrative or the arc of the story. And so I've dedicated a whole chapter to It's Time to Tell Your Story. And what I found while interviewing many, many amazing people is I asked them to share a story that they had not shared before with anyone else. And it was interesting. At first there was resistance, right?
Sure.
Probably based on fear. But then when they got emotionally comfortable, they, you know, I've heard some really phenomenal stories, which also inspired me to share some uncomfortable past stories as well. In the book, I write about being rejected from a gifted program when I was in the third grade, because a lot of people ask me, well, Gina, what is this obsession with genius? And I say, you know, I think it was, you know, it started in the third grade. They started this gifted program in my Catholic school, and I wasn't selected, and I was so disappointed by that. They said academically I was average, and I ended up writing about how my life would have changed if I was told I was gifted or if I possessed genius as a very young child. So I'm encouraging people to express their genius through stories, and also not to just share the stories of our great successes, but also some of the most biggest failures we've experienced, because I think that when you share your failures and you are able to shed light on that learning, the amount of people you're...
Gina, there's no such thing as a failure. We're starting to run out of time now. But with this message, though, there's two things that will cause a story to be effective. Are you ready for this?
Got it.
Dopamine and recognition. And with that, another time. is there a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. Practicalgenius.com. I welcome everyone to visit. Michael Ray, I want to thank you. This is my book launch week, so this is a huge honor. And if anyone would like to email me, that's Gina, G-I-N-A, at practicalgenius.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Take care.
And he shows up pearly white, just a jackknife that has old Mecca Heat, babe. And he keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, baby, scarlet billows start to spread. But fancy gloves, though, wears old Mecca Heat, babe. So there's never, never a trace of red. I let them things swing on the sidewalk. Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. And someone sneaking round the corner. Tell me, could that someone be Mac the Knife? Oh, there's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know? Well, cement bags just a hanging on down. Oh, that cement is there strictly for the weight, dear. Father'll get you 10 old Mackies back in town. Yeah, yeah, Bob Louie Miller.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And now Mecca Heat spins just like a shader. Could it be?
Alex Thurman with us. He's the co-author of Healing at the Speed of Sound, how what we hear transforms our brains and our lives, from music to silence and everything in between. He's an author. He's a producer whose products are used by people in more than 35 countries. His work is based on music effects research and principles of human development and neuroplasticity, focusing on improving academic, cognitive, and communication abilities. He's the founder and CEO of Advanced Brain Technologies, a leading provider of products which improve brain function with solutions for consumer schools, therapy clinics, healthcare facilities, and the military. Alex, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, thank you so much. Pleasure to be with you this evening.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Alex, when we talk about neuroplasticity, we talk about cognitive brain function, etc. Maybe 20 years ago, we thought about it, we experienced a few things. But in today's world, it is so critically important how our brains control basically everything that goes on, and how we can intentionally affect that brain to be able to experience and feel the things we'd like to.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. You know, it was, 20 years ago, there was a debate in the science in the sciences relative to whether or not the brain, in fact, was plastic. And what we mean by brain plasticity is the fact that the brain can change in response to the environment. In the last 20 years, we have had just dramatic research happen in the neurosciences showing us not only does the brain change in response to the environment, but we can design how the brain changes by using modifying our environment in very specific ways to get the outcomes that we want to achieve.
No, and by the way, when you really think about this, you know, people put this into an idea here. That you're in a bad mood and you're sitting someplace where there's some really nice music and you see someone and you ask them to dance. And during that period of time, the mood change because of the music, which creates the environment, makes all the difference in the world. So I really believe that we are so affected by those vibrational sounds that we take in and affected good and bad. It's the ability to recognize it before you react or respond to it.
Well, you know, music that feels good to us changes our brain chemistry, and it changes it for the positive. So it can increase endorphins, it can increase dopamine levels and give us that experience of pleasure like eating great chocolate, having good sex, or seeing a piece of art that we love. It makes us feel good and it changes our chemistry. But conversely, noise, sound which can do harm to us physiologically or psychologically, is really damaging our system. And that's something that we need to be vastly aware of, that the wrong sound can hurt us and the right sound can be harnessed and really improve our life.
No question about it. Where was it in all of your experience when you began to take a look at this and realize the impact that sound can have?
Well, interestingly, it's a personal story. I as a child had chronic ear infections and suffered from what's called auditory processing problems. My brain didn't always understand what it heard correctly. I remember I was a teenager and I was at a concert, and the music was too loud and I was listening for too long, and my ears started ringing after this event, and I couldn't figure out what that ringing was around me. And I later learned that it was tinnitus, that I had ringing in the ears. And in addition to that tinnitus, I became sensitive to certain sounds in my environment. And it absolutely altered how I experienced the world, because I had this constant sound present within my body that my body was creating, and I developed a sensitivity to the world. And that made me very aware of my auditory system, but also the need to do something about it. And I began my quest working on tools to help improve, you know, auditory development and auditory perception in the world.
Now, by the way, when I did the intro, not only the book, you were talking about, I was talking about, certain products and things that you've created. What are we talking about?
Well, we at Advanced Brain Technologies, we develop a number of very specialized audio products which improve sound brain fitness. And I think it's important to, first of all, define what sound brain fitness is, because it's analogous to physical fitness. You can define it as our general state of brain health, but it's also the process and the outcome that we're striving for. And what we're trying to do is help people engage in practices which support their auditory brain health. And the outcome of that is the optimal level of auditory performance. That allows us to better take in and filter out the information that we want in our world. We learn to learn with more proficiency, communicate more effectively, have optimal physical performance, and better regulate stress.
Let me hold you up just for a second.
Yeah.
Alex, let me hold you up. Let's say that in a way that the average person out here can put their arms around. If I come to you and I'm having problems, maybe it's pain, it's I can't concentrate or something, what do you put me through to get me to where I need to be?
We first of all understand where you're at and where you want to go. And then we design sound tools that you put into practice by listening through a system called the Listening Program, which is designed to be used daily. You put on headphones 15 to 30 minutes a day. You listen to specially recorded music that helps improve how your brain processes the environment. you know, how you understand what the sounds are in the environment, the loudness of sounds, how to block them out, the noise that we don't want, and how to take in the good nourishing sounds that make us to feel better.
Okay, can you do an example of, let's say, a client, you know, that obviously we're not going to mention names, but a client that you worked with that had a particular problem, how you designed a program for them and what happened to them and how they moved through it?
Well, one comes to mind. This is an adult that was in a serious automobile accident, and she had suffered from brain damage, and this brain injury affected how she thought, her ability to remember things, to speak, to hear, to see, to understand where her body was in space, and actually to move her body. So, you know, this was believed to be permanent brain damage, and her story is the absolute example of the brain's capacity to heal itself and to change itself. So she went through an intensive course of the listening program, and this was actually done by listening to the specialized music played through headphones, but also through what's called a bone conductor, a vibrator that connects to the skull in the headphones and sends vibration through the body in addition to the music that's being listened to. And what happened with this is that she made a dramatic recovery. After her accident, the first time she knew the program was working, I remember her telling me this story, she was walking through a noisy shopping mall, and she could hear her cell phone ring for the first time. She could not only hear the phone, but she was able to answer the phone and carry on a conversation easily. Then she began to notice improvements in her ability to learn new information and retain information. So not only did she recover from this brain injury through the use of this music, but she went on to do neuroscience research in the field. It was just really a beautiful story in understanding what her injury was, what her needs were, and then following a course of music listening therapy that helped aid in her recovery.
So she went on to help other people then?
She went on to help other people. She was so inspired that this has become her field of scientific study now.
Well,
PhD in cognitive neuroscience.
That's great. Let me bring this one home. Radio Susie's mom is got dementia. She has everything that anybody with Alzheimer's would have. Now, what kind of a program would you put Susie's mom on?
Well, I think one thing that's important to consider is that we can all live a healthy, sound diet. So the first thing to do is to move away from noise and then create a soundtrack for our daily life. And a way to create that soundtrack for each of us is to take the music that we have and that we already love in our music library. You know, whether we're using cloud-based music systems, CDs, or iTunes, we all have our music collection. And then we take that collection and we understand that we can put the music into three primary categories, what we call in healing at the speed of sound gears. First gear would be low tones, so more bass music in tempos below 60 beats per minute that you would consider to be calm and relaxing would be the first gear, more of your sonic sedative, something that's for relaxation and calming. The second gear would be tempos of closer to 50 to 90 beats per minute, largely instrumental music and vocal music, and all kinds of music can be used in first gear, but instrumental is quite good. Second gear, also instrumental in that 50 to 90 beat tempo range, and then mid to high frequency sounds. Then third gear would be more of the sonic caffeine. So this is music of a broad frequency band, faster tempos, you know, more music that you would get up and dance to. So to take that music, categorize it, build a playlist based on what we want to achieve in the day, you know, whether it's waking up or commuting, or in the case of her mother, something that's going to maybe bring a better quality of life, reduce stress and anxiety. And patients with dementia, we in particular recommend the music that they most loved, music that brings back a happy, joyful memory. You know, I think of the movie The Notebook, and that scene where the piano is played and the memories come back, and that character just comes back to a point in life that she was so joyful and so happy that it can be an opportunity to really improve quality of life for those people.
So in essence, based on what's going on with you, and as a matter of fact, you don't have to have anything really wrong if you want just your a fitness routine, if you want to work out every day, you want to do something, if you just want to eliminate the normal stresses in life. So there's a program that could be created to all the all of the degrees that we're talking about here.
Our brains are wired for sound, and we all love music. It's innate to who we are. You know, while music is not a universal language, music is something that is universal to each of us as human beings because we use it to celebrate, we use it to relax, we use it to exercise. So, for example, a number of studies have been done to show that different elements of music and the right music helps improve the work effect in a workout. It keeps us diverted and focused into the activity that we're doing. It can raise the heart rate. Can get the oxygen and blood circulating better so that we get more performance from our workout and get longer workouts. So the research in those areas are overwhelming. But also, you know, in today's world, especially with the economic downturn, which is, to put it lightly, we're in a deep economic recession, stress levels are very high. So people that would otherwise, you know, be doing great in life when we were enjoying the beautiful bubble that we were in have higher stress levels. So just using the right music to lower stress, reduce anxiety, that can make us, you know, lengthen the fuse, give us a higher tolerance for the negative things that happen in the day, but also to help us focus and concentrate and be more effective.
That really puts us in a position where you can make more money, or if you are that stressed, it clears you enough to be able to see what's ahead of you as far as a job, a profession, or whatever is concerned. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Alex, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, the book website is healingatthespeedofsound.com. Then the website for my company, Advanced Brain Technologies, is advancedbrain.com.
Dynamite. Hey, Alex, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, it was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me this evening.
Take care. Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah. I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Yes, and Julie Joyce with us, the author of Cancer-Free 123. 123, 123 things that prevent or destroy cancer, and the cancer-free grocery list. Very important. She's the executive producer and host of Cancer-Free Radio, international public radio program that teaches cancer prevention, nurtures cancer recovery, celebrates cancer survivors, and she interviews medical and pharmaceutical professionals, cancer researchers, health educators, cancer charity leaders, and inspiring survivors. And let us say, Julie Joyce, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. Very happy to join you today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Are you a cancer survivor?
Yes, I am. Actually, that was the premise and the basis and the the beginnings to all of this for me, because 12 years ago, after I gave birth to my daughter, very shortly after that, within about a month or so, discovered or started to encounter some problems that eventually were diagnosed as breast cancer. And it was kind of the what we call the summer from hell, because my mother, who lived with me, also was diagnosed with breast cancer that summer. Our family cat, breast cancer. The vet had breast cancer. It was just cancer was everywhere. And we just had to figure out some creative ways of mentally getting our minds around that. And I think once we were all done with all of our treatment, that was where the beginnings of this book really started, because I was staring at a little child that was inheriting a horrible legacy. And my first thought was, what in the heck can we do to change these circumstances for us? Our risk of either a recurrence of cancer or the risk that the rest of the family is engaging in a cancer experience. And there were a lot of other family members throughout the different legs of a family that had cancer. Cancer was always kind of coming up. And almost everybody knows somebody with cancer, because 1 in 3 people in the U.S. get cancer in their lifetime. So the beginnings of this was me wanting to get a handle on it.
What I learned years ago, you can't fix a problem unless you know what the problem is. And I think today, more and more, we're starting to discover what cancer is, but even some of the researchers have no idea. So can we come up with a definition? Well, we've got this practical definition we can put our arms around and say, oh, this is cancer. Now we know what it is we're dealing with.
Well, I think cancer is one of those words that just creates so much emotion and fear when someone hears it. But if you really break it down, it's actually quite simple. We have these millions of cells in our body, and on autopilot every day, they're growing, dividing, replicating, evolving. And there's this natural process that our body goes through where when a cell has kind of run its course, or it's weak, or it's damaged, it gets programmed for cell death. Our body has this built-in system on autopilot to get rid of the junk, to get rid of those cells, evict them before they could cause damage to the other healthy cells. So this process, which is called apoptosis, or programmed cell death, which makes it a lot easier to understand, is just on autopilot. And what happens, though, is that sometimes, and often, that's why sometimes we'll hear people say, oh, everybody has the potential to have cancer in their body, and we all do, because on any given day, we have damaged cells or cells in our body that they need to go. And for some reason, there's a breakdown in this process that our immune system takes care of for us. So what happens is those cells that are damaged become mutated, and instead of doing what they're supposed to do, is die and just kind of be expelled from the body. You know, like even see dead skin cells on your arms, all dead cells. It just needs to, it's time for them to go. And if they don't do what they're supposed to do, and they instead stay in the body and become mutated, and then they continue to multiply and grow in this deformed state, we start to have a cluster of bad cells that can become a tumor or growth of some type anywhere in the body. It can be benign, or it can become malignant. And the malignant ones are, of course, the ones we're concerned about, the cancerous ones, because they can start to invade healthy tissue, and they can start to spread to other parts throughout the body. And then if we just kind of understand that what's happening is cancer is just a cellular malfunction on a cellular level, something went wrong. And then we have to say, okay, well, what causes that? And we have to understand that there are things that occur in our immune system that either damage our immune system or boost our immune system. And those are the impacts. There are things that either are cancer feeders that help to feed the damage and allow the damage to continue, or cancer fighters, things that we can do that will help to boost that immune system and help to strengthen and protect the healthy cells and help to expel the damaged ones. And when you think of cancer like that, then you start to understand, wow, you know, it really is just things that you can control. And I think that that's the biggest message that I want people to get, that they would realize that when take all the statistics, all of the research, doesn't matter who did it or when it occurred, but the bottom line is when the government kind of assesses all that data together, at least 75% of cancer cases are caused by controllable factors. Things that we do that impact that function of the cells functioning and the immune system functioning properly. So when we know that, then that's when I say you do have the power to prevent cancer. You have the power to impact dramatically. I like to say 75% is controllable. Government statistics are actually more like 90, 95% of cancers are caused by the environment or lifestyle, these external things that we can control.
Let me give you just a little bit of it. Julie, let me give you just a little bit of a different twist on that. And everybody is born with cancer cells. This is automatic within us. What the problem is, and you talked about the immune system. The immune system job, it's to get rid of foreign cells, foreign bodies. The problem is with the cancer cells, they're not foreign. The immune system doesn't recognize them. And by the time it does get recognized, you just said it before, they proliferate, they grow, and then we have, quote unquote, the cancer problems. And I truly believe in my heart of hearts that the majority of cancer is preventable if you do the right things and not allow those cells to grow and to get out of control.
Well, it really is where the immune system knows that there's damage there. In a sense, that our body, when it's working at peak efficiency, will do what it can to either repair cells that are damaged or expel them completely and diminish them, overcome them in some way.
We're on the same side of the table. I completely agree. I think the only different twist is what I was saying is that the immune system doesn't recognize them until it is too late. That's what I've said.
Well, I think in a lot of cases where we've seen that even some people that have had advanced stages of cancer, that where you would probably define it as that it's too late, in a sense, where we're starting to deal with maybe metastases, where we're actually dealing with cancerous growths that are starting to invade healthy tissue in other areas of the body. I think when some people have done some very drastic measures, they've seen amazing results. So that to say that it's too late, I think, is sometimes maybe a little constrained because, everybody's different, everyone's body's different, and what they're willing to do is different. But to say that it's too late might be a little premature because in some cases where we've seen that people have just, they've already had a cancer diagnosis and they've just bitten the bullet and they've looked at everything that they're doing, especially dietary and habitually, especially like meat, for example. If they totally eliminated meat from their diet, and I know that's kind of hard for some people to, think about of totally giving up meat, but vegetarians are 50% less likely to die from cancer. These are people that are already diagnosed. The immune system's already discovered, we've already got cancer growing. And we weren't able to suppress that cell growth, damaged cell growth before it evolved into diagnosable cancer. But they're 50% less likely to die. Now, that's just one thing that is a cancer feeder, and that would be meat. And a lot of things contribute to that, the way it's cooked, the different chemicals that are released and attached to the meat, the different hormones and the different other chemicals and fillers that are in that meat that continue to damage cells. There are other things, eliminating tobacco completely from your environment, not just firsthand, but secondhand as well. Others who will eliminate excess weight. A lot of the carcinogens that we come into contact with that might be damaging our cells, what some people don't realize is that a lot of these carcinogens are lipophilic. They love fat. So if you take someone who's overweight and someone who's a leaner counterpart, that overweight person is already at increased risk. So by dramatically reducing fat in the body, totally changing the diet dramatically, I guess what I'm just trying to say is it's not necessarily too late. There's still a chance to help that immune system get back in control and to do what it can to eradicate damage that's in the body. Now, it doesn't mean in every case, and every case is individual.
Julie, when I said too late, it wasn't too late you got cancer, you're going to die. It was too late for a point.
And then true. But, you know, it's just one of those things where I guess my biggest and most important message that I like to impress upon people, because cancer seems to be one of those things that people get so resolved to that, oh, it's everywhere, there's nothing we could do about it, oh, I might as well smoke, everyone's going to get cancer and die. You know, you hear people say ridiculous things like that, and I think what I like to impress upon people is that they don't realize just how much of this formula that's going on inside their body that they actually can control and that they can impact, significantly influence what's happening inside their body and how healthy they'll be based on controlling what's happening on the outside.
No question about that. And I don't want to get into it too deeply, but I've been there. I've done that. I've been through cancer. And I've seen what you can do and what you can't do. And I've seen what a mindset will do if you decide that that's it. Mm-hmm. If somebody else wants to die, let them. I'm not into that right now. But a lot of it, too, is a mindset. And a lot of it, too, is what you eat and your nutrition and, you know, the dietary supplements and so on and so forth. One of the first things they did to me was they started giving me vitamin C IVs. So, you know, I mean, I went through it with no chemotherapy, no radiation. That was 13, 14 years ago. And I was supposed to be dead about a year and a half after I was diagnosed. But the point of contention, I'm on your side of the table. I totally believe what you're saying because you don't have to die and you can live a cancer-free and an average life.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes what people don't realize just how simple some of those changes are. Like you said, it's like a vitamin C, something as simple as an antioxidant supplement can impact. But there are things that sometimes people don't realize because you don't necessarily hear about there being a direct connection. Getting enough sleep, doing what you can to reduce stress. I think even your last caller talked about sounds and how that impacts your stress level in your body and how that can impact your whole life and your whole sense of being. And those are factors that influence your cell development and your immune system. So meditating, getting enough sleep, making sure you are getting those 7 hours minimum that an adult needs, doing what you can to reduce stress. Yoga, laughter yoga, which doesn't involve any funny twists. All you have to do is laugh, and it just releases endorphins and chemicals that help to boost that immune system. And then, of course, all the obvious things, you know, the fruits and the vegetables, those obvious green leafy, colorful vegetables that are loaded with antioxidants, which are kind of like natural chemo in a way. They help to repair some cell damage. They help to expel bad cells, and they help to nurture the growth of healthy cells, making sure that you just have a diet that's less in meat as much as possible.
Let me hold you up. Did you, wait, did you, have you ever heard of PolyMVA, P-O-L-Y, M as in Michael, V as in Victor, A as in Allison?
Have you ever heard
of that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It kind of sounds familiar, but.
I did Google it. I think you'll find some interesting things.
Have to look at that. And there's so many, you know, new developments in this area, especially in nutrition, that are continually occurring. And they're all very encouraging because it all sides on the side of having more control on this whole balance that's going on in the body. And it's so many functions are happening on autopilot, and the more we throw in there, that improves the outcome. I always like to say if you just change one thing, it changes everything. And if you change some element of what's going on the external side of your body, coming into the body, and internally, you dramatically can change the outcome. And I think it's important for people to realize that they do have a lot of control over what's happening inside their body and whether or not they need to be resolved to just accepting that they're going to be one in the three having cancer in their lifetime or actually doing what they can to make sure that they're on the other side and that we do what we can to change that statistic.
No question. And Julie, we're starting to run out of time now. Do you have a website that we can find you, find out more about what you do, buy the book?
Absolutely. And even before, if someone's not ready for the full book yet, I have a free Are You Becoming a Cancer Magnet checklist book on the website, and a free audio that kind of discusses a little bit of this. So that's a wonderful place to start. And if you just go to cancerfreeradio.com, in the upper hand, right-hand side, you can access the free book and the free audio, The Power to Prevent Cancer. And it gives you kind of a good background on this to get started and to realize exactly where your power is, and then go from there, you know, and learning more to change your lifestyle and do what you can to really reduce the risk. The important thing is to realize that you don't just affect your life, you affect those people around you. That one in three could be your household right now. So just look around in your household, look at somebody to the left, somebody to the right. You don't want anybody to be that one in three. So whatever you do, you just change that one thing and you change everything. You change the outcome.
Wonderful. Hey, Julie Joyce, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share some cancer prevention tips today. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do.